carrefour des arts. Une émission de la rédaction de Canal Académie. On retrouve Christa Leuk.
The Golden Age of German Romanticism. Watercolors and drawings at the time of Goethe. An exhibition at the Musée de la Vie Romantique in Paris until the 15th of June 2008. And Canal Académie is very pleased to receive Mr. Daniel Marchessault, director of this beautiful and, one might even say, charming museum in the heart of Paris. Mr. Daniel Marchessault, hello.
Hello.
You are also co-commissioner of this exhibition together with Mr. Hinrich Sieveking, a German art historian who has kindly accepted to come to Canal Académie later to share his experience with us in German. So let us first say some words about the exceedingly romantic museum you are fortunate to direct and where the exhibition is taking place. Wasn't it the former home of a dynasty of artists? And is it exclusively dedicated to romantic artists?
Well, the property was built in 1830 for a famous painter at the time called Ari Scheffer.
Yes.
Ari Scheffer is from Dutch descent.
Mm-hmm.
And he arrived in Paris as a teenager with his family and lived there from 1830 until his death. And he was a prominent painter of King Louis-Philippe. And the property remained in the family till 1982, where it was bequeathed to the city of Paris. And finally, the Musée de la Vie Romantique opened in 1987. We had, of course, it was a private home, so we had to renovate it in order to make it as a museum. And now we display a large number of memorabilia of the famous romantic French writer, Georges Sand. And, of course, we keep a large number of works by Ari Scheffer himself. Now, apart from that, we do have two beautiful artist studios where Ari Scheffer used to paint and to receive a number of guests. So this is where we do hold exhibitions twice a year, and where we have at the moment the German Romantic Drawings exhibit.
Yes. In your program, you not only have romantic artists, but you also have some modern artists, I understood.
Yes, we have organized a few exhibitions on kind of outsiders, so to speak, of the 20th modern movement, such as Richard Lindner, for instance, who was from German background and who died in New York, who had lived in America for a long time. We had also an important Picasso show focused on his collaboration with the engraver Pierrot Comlinck. Vast, vast portfolio of prints, but also a very, very famous draftsman and pastel painter called, who's living now, of course, Sam Safran. And we might, in the future, consider other
projects. So it's not exclusively dedicated
No.
to the beginning of the 19th century of the Romantics. But nevertheless, let's come back to our subject of the day, to the golden age of German Romanticism. And hasn't this notion of German Romanticism been cheapened in a way by overuse? Even Pierre Rosenberg of the Académie Française, who also contributed to the exhibition's very, very fine catalogue, I must say, and he says that the word Romanticism has been emptied of its meaning and of any meaning. That's rather severe, isn't it? What do you think about it?
It's not that severe. I think it's pretty accurate. In fact, the word Romanticism has British roots,
mm-hmm.
comes from Romanesque.
Mm-hmm.
And this movement, interestingly enough, the British Romanticism and German Romanticism started earlier in those countries than in France, where, first of all, we had a very strong influence of the Enlightenment movement in France. And then burst out the Révolution Française, the French Revolution. That's not the case neither in England nor in Germany. Also, one of the first major writer to contribute to this reappreciation of the Romanesque, the Roman era in the Middle Ages is Walter Scott.
Mm-hmm.
And Walter Scott and a number of British writers, of course, did publish a number of novels or short stories which anticipated on their consequences in the cultural scene, so to speak, including, of course, the painters, the draftsmen,
the philosophers
musicians. And so on, and of course the musicians.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And you date this Age of Goethe, as it is called, from 1770 to 1830. So apparently you made it end with the Goethe's death in 1832.
Yes, well, the show focuses on those 60 years. It's not that really drastic. You have a few works
in the exhibition.
In the exhibition, which have been done just a few years before 1770, and a few other works being executed later than 1830. But that's the core of the exhibition, which includes 124 pages. I mean, that's a very important show in terms of number, not mentioning the quality of the sheets. The core of the exhibition focuses on this specific period.
Yes, yes. And this was quite some period because, as you already mentioned it, it was the period of the Enlightenment in France, and in Germany you had later on you had the influence also of the French Revolution, of course, and then the Napoleonic occupation in Germany and the liberation wars, and then the Restoration and the famous Sturm und Drang, storm and stress, and even until the Biedermeier, until the 19th century. So these different currents influence Goethe's work, and also they can be seen the works of the artists of your exhibition. These different political and historical and sociological and maybe even scientific movements.
Well, it is a truism to say that this period is...
Of about 50 years.
About 50, 60 years is, of course, extremely innovative in terms of the progress of the mind, of the philosophy, of the poetry, and the very keen interest about physics, science, natural history. There is a prominent figure for European intellectual history, who is Alexander von Humboldt, whose reputation is extremely wide, even though we usually know too little about his fabulous intelligence, invention, discoveries. He was a geographer, he was a scientist, and he was highly, probably the most prominent figure in the scientific world. He is represented in the show by an extraordinary self-portrait, which is as precise as his observation on the mountains of the Andes.
Latin American
chain of mountains. And this proves at the same time his pride, but also the very high respectability to which he had attained in those years. He was also an extraordinary scientist in terms of the study of the sky, of the weather, of all these natural phenomena that were to influence so many scientists during the first half of the 19th century. Mm.
So he was really an enlightened
figure and spirit. And he is a perfect match, so to speak, between Germany and France, since he lived for 23 years in Paris, very near the Académie Française.
Yes.
And, of course, in those days, as Marc Fumaroli, another of your académiciens français, wrote, "Quand l'Europe parlait français," when Europe did speak French, and everybody indeed did speak French in those days, whereas today it's English.
So there was some exchange between France and Germany.
Undoubtedly.
Yes. And could you maybe give us a definition or a synthesis of this exceedingly generalized notion of German Romanticism? Is it possible?
German Romanticism has to deal not only with drawing, it has to do also with literature, poetry, music,
architecture,
as we said. Goethe, of course, is the key figure. Mm. Interestingly enough, Goethe, about 10 years, didn't know whether he would become a draftsman or a writer, even though when he was very young, he did publish Werther. He was still focusing on drawing. And he decided to switch to literature when he went to Rome and found out that there was no way he could qualify as the antique Roman artists of the Roman era did. That was the end of it. That was the end of it. We certainly all can understand that. The awareness of the German intellectuals between 1770 up to 1820 or 1830 of the so-called German roots of the medieval era on one hand, and of the desire to express their own personal passion on the other hand, tempered by the extreme weight of religion, Protestant in the North, Catholic in the South, makes it a very complex movement which has a uniqueness that cannot be compared to so-called British Romanticism or the French Romanticism. The British Romanticism could be and lived by someone like William Blake, for instance.
A contemporary of Goethe, by the way.
A contemporary of Goethe, by the way. And in fact, we will organize a William Blake show next year.
I'm already looking forward to hear you talking about it.
But Walter Scott, who writes, who publishes in the late 80s and early 90s, 1780s, 1790s, is certainly one of the first enlightened romantic writers, whereas Chateaubriand in France, for instance, we will have to wait another 15 years or 20 years before he publishes. And of course, his influence will be very strong in the 1810s, 1820s, whereas in France, whereas Goethe and Scott and others were in their own country influential much earlier.
But you mean the German Romanticism was very much, if not exclusively, but very much influenced by this religious research or by this, common value of religion, if it was Protestant in the North and Catholic in the South, but this soul, this famous German soul, and the Weltanschauung, etc. You mean that's maybe the...
It's probably one of the keys. It's probably not the only one. It's probably not the only one. And, of course, the fact that Germany is not a country in those days, you know, it's a mosaic of little states, little cities, independent powers.
Counties,
a kind of an aristocracy which is scattered around a huge territory, you know, really vast territory. But, of course, you have rivalries, you have fights, you have... And each city or each power wants to find and to impose its own identity. You will find in those days, of course, three or four major universities and major academies. Of course, Dresden, Berlin, Munich, Vienna, and a few others. Of course, that's not the case neither in France nor in Great Britain. So the royal power in France makes it, and then, of course, the imperial power with Napoleon makes it all very different. Each of these smaller
local powers
had their own will of existing by themselves. And they would promote, in a way, the arts as much as they could. But, of course, there was not as many means as
the central power,
in France.
Of course,
very different.
But talking about the arts, you explained that drawing was the main and most distinguished artistic expression in the field of the fine arts at this time in Germany.
Yes. Well, one of the reasons is the remembrance of the era of Albrecht Dürer, 2 centuries earlier, and his followers, you know, Altdorfer and many others. And of course, there was a large, large diffusion of Dürer's engravings in those days. And there was a keen interest, a keen will of all these young artists to develop a draftsmanship which they intended to be as powerful and as they were so eager to develop it the way Dürer had done it previously. All these artists were trained pretty early in Germany, as everywhere else. Many of them passed away very young. Mm. And this is also one of the reasons why we do not keep a number of more important works, because they had no time to execute them. A genius like Runge dies when he is 33. He intended to do a set of 6 huge murals. He did only one because he passed away in the process of doing this. So many of these artists are known only by sheets that are works as such. I mean, they really insisted on believing that drawing is an art by itself, which would not compete with painting or sculpture. And it is true that when you look at many of those sheets, you will see an eagerness to be as precise, as intense in terms of the vision of the drawing, the interior feeling of it, that of course it takes as much time to realize as an oil on canvas, you know.
Yes, yes. It is absolutely fascinating.
It's extraordinary.
Yes.
And but it's true that many, many, many of those artists passed, you know, fairly young.
But even in this short time of life, it's absolutely overwhelming to see the quality, the refinement, and the enthusiastic intensity of what they express, either in the landscapes or in the portraits, and it's absolutely fabulous. But we'll keep you for another part of the program to guide us, if you want, and if you please, to guide us through the different exhibition rooms. But before we make a little break, and maybe with some notes of Schubert.
Fremd bin ich eingezogen, fremd zieh ich wieder aus, der Mai war mir gewogen mit manchem Blumenstrauß. Das Mädchen sprach von Liebe, die Mutter gar von Lied. Das Mädchen sprach von Liebe, die Mutter gar von Lied.
Daniel Marchessault, the director of the Musée de la Vie Romantique in Paris, is with us in the studio of Canal Académie. He's also the co-commissioner of the exhibition The Golden Age of German Romanticism. And we shall come to the heart of the subject as we discover the main artists of this selection. And here I would like to pay a particular tribute to the organizers. The works presented here seem very confidential and limited in time and genre. And nonetheless, they open a whole universe. As though through a magnifying glass, one gets to look into the soul of this period with its metaphysical outbursts and concrete life. You can find here, as you mentioned before, 124 exceptional drawings in watercolors. So, Daniel Marchessault, would you kindly guide us through the different exhibition rooms? And we can start with the first one, where we find a drawing by the great Goethe, a Veduta of Rome.
Goethe had an early training for drawing, and he wanted to be a draftsman. What's interesting is that on a sketchbook, he would note as his own personal diary a number of vedute of his discoveries in Rome. Interestingly enough, you can even today sit more or less where he was, and you know exactly what kind of veduta he had in front of him. And it is so precise and evocative. Interestingly enough, many of these drawings don't have a lot of color. The German soul is much more into draftsmanship than into watercolor and color. And strangely enough, the interpretation of the southern light of Italy escapes to a number of German artists, whereas at the same time, they would not escape a number of French artists. It's just a matter of their own sensitivity. But what they achieved so thoroughly, either in the German light, the northern part of Europe, or in the southern part of Europe, is an intricacy between the landscape setting, so to speak, and the position of mankind. And very often you can see the modesty, the very small size, the very small scale of a human being in the vastness of the landscape. Even though there are a number of landscapes, and that includes, of course, the two beautiful landscapes by Caspar David Friedrich, where you don't even have a human figure, which means that the end of the 18th century, beginning of the 19th century, the position, the presence of mankind is considered with a certain shyness by the artist. Would that be, let's ask us the question, could that be some kind of a self-portrait, each of these sheets, you know?
You're speaking about Caspar David Friedrich in particular?
No, but many others, many other artists, just questioning the position of man in front of this extraordinary, newly discovered nature, newly discovered landscape, newly discovered universe, so to speak. We're not that far from the medieval concern about the space that man should occupy in front of this vastness of a religious world, of a divine power, and of a supernatural nature.
Of course, yes.
And in a way, that's part of probably the Sturm und Drang questioning.
Yes.
After the Enlightenment, where, of course, with the Siècle des Lumières, with the Aufklärung, things were probably much more secure, so to speak. The questioning,
it was more rational movement.
Yeah, it was much more rational. And maybe the French philosophers and L'Encyclopédie started it all. And then there was some kind of evolution in the questioning.
Yes. Also, it concerns much more the German, say, identity or their values to have this, as I mentioned before, this metaphysical research how to, as you said so marvelously well, the humble man, the humble human figure in front of this immense cosmic feeling of maybe God, universe, and the questionings. And it's very, very typical of this German romanticism movement, absolutely. And you have in your exhibition several emblematic figures, maybe they deserve some special mention. We talked about Caspar David Friedrich, but maybe not enough yet. We'll see. Other names like Philipp Otto Runge, marvelous designer also. Füssli, who is Swiss, but well known. And I think he went to Brittany, to Great Britain.
Yes, in fact, the British consider Füssli to be British.
To be English, yes.
In fact, he did. He went first to Italy. Füssli changed the spelling of his name. Mm.
And they write Füsseli.
Yes, he wrote it Füsseli. And then he went to Britain and kept this Italian spelling and lived all his life in Britain, in London. So that's pretty odd that he would leave Zurich and his German background to go first to Italy and then move north, even northern, than Switzerland to go to Britain.
Yes.
Where he was highly praised.
He left the sun and he went to the night. And then we have Tischbein, quite well known. He was a friend of Goethe and they were together in Italy.
Yes, they were together in Rome.
Angelika Kaufmann, another famous figure.
Angelika Kaufmann is interesting because she's the only woman in that show, but she's really one of the only women in German art of the period. There was Rosalba Carriera in Italy at the turn of the 18th century. Then, of course, we had in France, among others, but probably the most famous was Elisabeth Vigée-Lebrun. But we also had Anne Vallière-Coster and a few others. But Angelika Kaufmann is a really prominent figure of the time, even though she was born in Vienna and then went to Italy and then to Britain. So she is included in the show because of her background, of her German background, but also because she did this extraordinary drawing, which is an homage to Goethe, whom, of course, she met in Rome.
And admired
very much. And you have this beautiful interpretation of an homage to Goethe as she represents herself as a kind of self-portrait, so praising a bust of Goethe by a German artist called Trimmel. Mm-hmm. So this is a real proof of that extraordinary admiration between the two.
Yes. Well, she was also an admirer of Winckelmann, another very central figure of this time.
Yes, but Winckelmann probably was more theoretical.
Yes, yes.
But of course, he had an extraordinary influence. On not only on her, but on a whole generation.
Yes.
And he was, of course, one of the first to encourage that new generation to come to Rome and to learn much more. In those years, as we said, Germany was not a united country. It's not Deutschland. You know, that's where we have the difference between Allemagne and Germanie in France. We don't have such a difference. We don't have two words in English, as far as I know. But it's interesting that the British language has kept the word German as the significance of a people in a certain territory using the same language, whereas Deutschland means a political unity.
Mm-hmm. Which was not the case then.
Which was not the case in those years.
Mm, yes, yes.
Neither was it in Italy.
Yes.
Of course.
Yeah. Of course, yes. Other emblematic figures, von Dillis, Moritz von Schwind, well-known Richter. Maybe some comments?
Well, Moritz von Schwind is probably one of my favorite drawings, but there are so many.
Yes, there are so many.
In any event, there's this apparition dans la forêt, apparition in the forest. So you have this extremely beautiful feminine apparition, like a ghost, under the moon crescent, and you have this handsome young knight on a horse. The whole scene is a night scene in the deep of the forest. And all this is extremely keenly drawn. There's no color. It's brown ink. It's sepia. And you can see, you can smell the flavor of the forest. You can remember these medieval legends that fascinated the young readers in those days. And
yeah, you're really sort of lost in the middle of the forest.
Yeah, and you are in love with that feminine figure who disappears like this. You're running, the knight is running after her. That's a very, very romantic drawing indeed.
By Moritz von Schwind.
By Moritz von Schwind. Yes. I have this one also, but anyway.
And von Dillis is also absolutely marvelous.
Von Dillis was the king's visit on Mount Hesselberg. It's an extraordinary watercolor, extremely keen in terms of the chromatism and the way he did study his palette. And it's also interesting because it's really the cold light of the northern part of Germany, which is very near Prussia. And you can see in civil clothes the king and the queen of Prussia wandering around these mounds. So it is really the narration of, again, the wanderer, the walker, the passerby. It's the beginning of tourism, you know, and this new discovery of nature. And that's really new in those years.
So we talked already a little bit about Italy, but there is a whole room dedicated to Italy and with the title The Happiness of Independence with No Limits and Constraints, a quotation by Reinhardt, where you can find the fight against storm, for instance, following Schiller's ideas of the freedom of mind.
We could say that in any country, that's indeed very true at the period, in the period of Romanticism in Germany. Among art, I mean, all these artists do anticipate a questioning of society, sometimes ahead of their contemporaries. The questioning about nature, about
existence,
about
life.
Existence, about mankind in front of the universe, in front of what could be called in those years of scientific studies, of geography, of the skies, of the stars, of the questioning of all these scientists, have a kind of resonance for a number of artists who, without knowing precisely what are the researchers of the time, they just instinctively feel it and express it their own way. And interestingly enough, a number of these artists have invented in their media, in their technique, in their palette, with their very keen sense of observation, they have expressed the anxieties that would, in the following years, be common to a full generation, whether they are painters or writers or musicians. There is this anticipation, a kind of a power of divination. And that has been true for many, many centuries. It's even true now. I mean, if you think of Anselm Kiefer, being of a German, romantic,
yes, would, yes.
Artist of today.
Contemporary romantic.
Contemporary.
Romantic is, romantic is a very particular romantic.
Yes,
artist.
But I mean,
was the same
fascination for passion, for war, for religion, his extraordinary knowledge of
material and nature.
Yeah, but also from Christian religions as well as Jewish religion, as well as Buddhism, as well as... So he has an extraordinary perception of the human mind. And I guess that was also true in those days. Interestingly enough, we were speaking of the extraordinary variety of the drawings that are shown here. There's one which I especially like. It is by Schinkel in a work called The Sailing on the Königssee. You will see the quality of the drawing, which, of course, evokes the Dürer way of drawing, but also some extraordinary inventions in terms of the treatment, for instance, of the shadows, of the clouds, of the water, which will be known only 70 years or 50 years later, which is the treatment of the Japanese prince. Hiroshige,
which was discovered in Europe much later by Monet.
After 1870, when Japan opened itself to the Western. So the artists have this kind of superpower to infiltrate the mind and define what will be the core of their anxieties or the questions in the future.
Another movement maybe we must not forget are the Nazarenes.
Well, the Nazarenes is probably the glory of German Romanticism, since it gives it its blooming and ending presence. Overbeck, who was from Austrian background and from a Protestant background also, moved from Vienna to Rome, where eventually he decided to live, stay, and die. He was the mentor of the group. So Overbeck greeted in the Convento San Isidoro in Rome a large number of artists, and this community was keen on establishing new principles to go back to the roots of what their feeling was about drawing. This is what they call the Nazarenes. And of course, apart from Overbeck, someone like Schnorr von Karelsfeld was extremely influential. And Schnorr von Karelsfeld was, of course, influenced not only by the classical artists of the 17th century, but also gave it some kind of a technique which would help him not only to represent daily genre scenes, but also to use it to give us his vision of certain German medieval legends. And by this, I'm referring, of course, to the death of Siegfried by Hagen, the
Nibelungen.
The Nibelungen, the saga. Which really, the saga. And you will see that, of course, Schnorr von Karelsfeld finally is a perfect match between the neo-Gothic revival in terms of the history themes and what will be the core of Wagner's inspiration later. 50 years later. So again, you can see that someone like Schnorr anticipates.
Extraordinary.
It's part of his genius, you know.
Yes.
But he's not the only one.
To
see how music will be or can be concerned in this exhibition, because there's a great presence of music in those streets.
Yes. Thanks to your elucidations, you discover fabulous variety of all these meanings, not only the fine drawings, but this mental inspiration and also the anticipation, as you just explained. So really, we are lucky to have this very fine exhibition. Unfortunately, it will end very soon in June, and it was programmed only for the Musée de la Vie Romantique in Paris. So there's no chance to see it in some other place?
Unfortunately not.
That is very
well
dommage.
Yeah, but to gather 124 exceptional sheets was a very strong burden for Heinrich Sieverking, who convinced every single lender, and that was only for one venue.
For one exhibition. Yes. It's too bad. But everyone who listens to our program at Canal Academy can get the fabulous catalog published by Paris Musée, which is the publisher
of the City of Paris Museum.
But
you can get the catalog through internet. On Amazon.com and
that's a good idea.
On AB Books and they're very easy to get.
Let me just add one thought which came to my mind as I looked at all these works. Their ephemeral character, both in technique and in genre, and you talked a lot about this whole inspiration of the genre and the technique, the fleeting instant passing by, and remaining everlasting until our times, which translates a very strong and deeply moving fragility. So you have all these different, like a kaleidoscope, all these different impressions by looking at and admiring these different drawings. And there, in this exhibition, you have mainly landscapes and portraits, but not only. You have many mythological scenes also.
Yes, which are, of course, part of landscape, and, of course, history painting, of course, refers to landscape at the same time as the portrait, the subject and the themes and so on.
So after this very interesting interview, we are lucky to have heard. One might say that you are a lover of the German Romanticism, isn't it so?
Yes. But next year I'll be a lover of William Blake.
Of William Blake, another exhibition which you're preparing right now. As we said, he's a contemporary of Goethe, so we don't leave completely the German Romanticism. We just go and
on the other side of the channel.
Yes. So thank you very, very much, Daniel Marchiso, for leading us back to Goethe's period of German Romanticism and showing us these very delicate drawings and watercolors. And
thank
I remember
you.
They are still to be seen until the 15th of June 2008 at the Musée de la Vie Romantique in the center of Paris, not very far off of Montmartre.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you so much. Goodbye.
Thank you.